This is part three of Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Why do we put up with it? Why do we tolerate them? Why do we tolerate these men who use nuclear weapons to blackmail the entire human race? Arundhati Roy. Knowing what is wrong with society is not the same as being able to change it. To change the world, we need to know how the few maintain their power over the many, and how this hold can be broken. The capitalist class is so small in numbers that they would drown if we all spat at them at the same time. It sounds so simple. However, accomplishing such a feat would require agreement about who should be spit on, agreement about who should not be spit on, agreement that spitting is the preferred action, and sufficient numbers to organize and participate in the spitting. The people in power are determined to prevent this level of clarity and organization. By keeping the majority confused and divided, so they don't know who are their enemies, who are their friends, what should be done, and who should do it, the status quo can be maintained. Part 3 examines four basic methods for keeping the majority subordinate. Each is powerful on its own. In combination, they present a formidable barrier to change. However, as Part 4 explains, these barriers have been overcome in the past and can be overcome again. Chapter 9, The Lies That Bind Us, reveals the deceptions that keep the elite in power. Chapter 10, Blame the Victim, explains how blaming the victim protects the system. Chapter 11, Divide and Rule, exposes how the few divide the many in order to rule them. Chapter 12, Suffer the Children, shows how the oppression of children maintains the system. Chapter 9, The Lies That Bind Us. To tell deliberate lies while genuinely believing in them, to forget any fact that has become inconvenient, and then, when it becomes necessary again, to draw it back from oblivion for just as long as it is needed, to deny the existence of objective reality, and all the while to take account of the reality which one denies, all this is indispensably necessary. George Orwell. More than 50 years ago, Orwell wrote this passage from 1984 to describe how the elite manipulate information to stay in power. The novel's main character works at the Ministry of Truth, where he deletes facts from the public records. In 2005, the chief of staff for the White House Council on Environmental Quality was discovered editing government reports to minimize the connection between fossil fuel emissions and global warming. In 2004, more than 60 leading scientists issued a public statement condemning the Bush administration for distorting and censoring scientific findings that contradict its policies. Among other things, the government was accused of, quote, repeatedly censoring and suppressing reports by its own scientists, stacking advisory committees with unqualified political appointees, disbanding government panels that provide unwanted advice and refusing to seek any independent scientific expertise in some cases, close quote. Orwell wrote 1984, shortly after World War II, when the so-called Glorious War turned out to be a horrific slaughter. In Orwell's novel, as in life, nothing is as it seems. The Ministry of Truth dispenses lies. The Ministry of Peace conducts war. The Ministry of Love operates the penal system. And the Ministry of Plenty supervises the exploitation of workers. The ruling party has three slogans. War is peace, freedom is slavery, and ignorance is strength. One could add a fourth slogan for today. Imperialism is democracy. This chapter explains why the capitalist class lies and why we believe them. The birth of capitalism. The Middle Ages is commonly portrayed as a stagnant period where nothing much happened. In fact, a gradual accumulation of discoveries and inventions laid the foundation for industrial society. By the 16th century, innovations in mathematics, engineering, metalworking, and navigation had increased productivity so much that an abundant future seemed inevitable. However, industrial capitalism had reached the limit of what it could achieve within the social framework of feudalism. Feudalism was based on the land. Capitalism built cities. Feudalism revered custom and tradition. Capitalism promised progress. Feudalism feared science. Science was essential to industry, and industry was the motor of capitalism. Conflict was inevitable. During the French Revolution, the capitalist class overthrew the lords of the land and took power. Being too weak to depose the aristocracy on its own, the capitalist class mobilized the working population to fight under the banner of liberty, equality, and brotherhood. However, once they secured power, the new capitalist rulers called a halt to the revolution. When workers pressed to continue the fight, their former leaders turned on them in a bloody slaughter. As it turned out, the two classes define liberty, equality, and brotherhood quite differently. For capitalists, liberty means freedom from restrictions on trade and commerce. Equality means an end to the privilege of birth, replaced by the privilege of money. And brotherhood only lasts as long as it serves their interests. For working people, liberty means freedom from exploitation and oppression. Equality means no class divisions, and brotherhood means a sharing society. None of these is possible under capitalism. Capitalists in England were horrified by the French Revolution. Like their counterparts in France, they longed to break free of feudal restrictions. Yet they feared to rouse a working class that could rebel against capitalist masters as easily as feudal lords. They had reason to fear. The Chartist movement in Britain was organizing tens of thousands of workers to demand democratic rights. In 1842, workers in Lancashire organized the first general strike in history. 5 years later, the Communist Manifesto urged workers to build a new society based on workers' control of production. In the spring of 1848, there were mass revolts against Europe's remaining autocracy. Again, workers joined with capitalists to break down feudal restrictions. The growing power of the working class frightened the capitalists, who switched sides and joined the aristocrats in crushing the revolt that threatened to sweep them both away. Seeing the writing on the wall, the European monarchies agreed to cede power to the capitalist class in exchange for retaining some of their privileges. The capitalist bid for power revealed a central weakness in the capitalist order. Feudalism had church doctrine to justify class inequality. Having broken the power of the church, capitalism needed some other way to control the masses. Freedom is slavery. America was built on slavery, indentured servitude, and the theft of native land. The 1705 Virginia Slave Code declared all non-Christian servants entering the colony to be slaves, defined slaves as real estate, and acquitted masters who killed slaves during punishment. By 1763, almost half the population of Virginia were slaves. As the American colonies struggled to free themselves from British domination, they raised the cry for freedom and democracy. However, the elite had no wish to free the slaves who produced their wealth. So the Founding Fathers enshrined the first official lie of the fledgling nation in the 1776 Declaration of Independence, to proclaim that all men are created equal, while maintaining a slave-based economy, equates freedom with slavery. The doctrine of racial inferiority was designed to resolve this contradiction. As historian Barbara J. Fields explains, quote, "Bondage does not need justifying as long as it seems to be the natural order of things. You need a radical affirmation of bondage only where you have a radical affirmation of freedom." Close quote. The second contradiction was to promote democracy while denying the majority any control over the direction of society. To keep power in the hands of the elite, the Constitution denied the vote to all women and to all men without property. When official policy declares that all people are created equal and denies rights to some people, then additional doctrines are needed to designate some people as less than human. The doctrine that blacks, women, and working class people are inferior served this purpose. Lies built on lies. In 1791, Congress amended the Constitution to guarantee the right to free speech. A few years later, Congress passed the Sedition Act of 1798, making it a crime to say or write anything against the government. Ignorance is strength. Despite this law, slave revolts and workers' rebellions continued to rock the nation. The Civil War interrupted the class struggle, but not for long. In 1872, a strike by 100,000 workers in New York City won the 8-hour workday, and 150,000 people paraded through the streets in celebration. Beginning in the mid-1890s, the number of strikes per year rose steadily to reach 4,000 in 1904. Between 1899 and 1904, union membership quadrupled to more than 2 million. Capitalism had broken feudalism's constraints on society and roused people's longing for a better life. It had also organized workers into large industries where they had their hands on the levers of production. To stay in power, the capitalist class needed absolute control over production. Union organizers were threatened, beaten, jailed, tortured, deported, and killed. In 1914, the National Guard machine-gunned and then set fire to the tents of miners striking against Rockefeller's Colorado Fuel and Iron Corporation. 26 men, women, and children died in what came to be known as the Ludlow Massacre. Such actions only deepened people's hatred of the robber barons and the government officials who served them. The working class had become too large and too powerful to be controlled by force alone. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Ignorance is strength. If you can control people by force, it's not so important to control what they think and feel. But if you lose the capacity to control people by force, it becomes necessary to control attitudes and opinions. Noam Chomsky. The capitalist class did not see the prospect of a better world in workers' rebellions, only the loss of their power and privilege. The feudal aristocracy had thought the same thing when the capitalists threatened to depose them. All ruling classes want history to end with their rule, and the capitalist class is no different. Capitalism was confronted with an inescapable problem. Class-divided societies are incompatible with genuine democracy. A numerically small ruling class cannot impose its will on a larger population as long as that population is actively involved in political life. A section of the middle class proposed a solution: control the majority by manipulating their minds. As early as 1895, French sociologist Gustave Le Bon warned in The Crowd, A Study of the Popular Mind, quote, "Today, the claims of the masses are becoming more and more sharply defined and amount to nothing less than a determination to destroy utterly society as it now exists. The divine right of the masses is about to replace the divine right of kings." Close quote. In 1916, Wilfred Trotter wrote The Instincts of the Herd in Peace and War, in which he argued that workers' revolts and anti-war protests were based on mindless herd instinct. Sigmund Freud built on Le Bon and Trotter's work. In Group Psychology and the Analysis of the Ego, Freud argues that being in a crowd overrides the social constraints that keep animal instincts under control. In 1930, he wrote Civilization and Its Discontents, warning that civilization must control the savage forces that would otherwise rise up to destroy it. In The Future of Illusion, he argues that, quote, "these dangerous masses must be held down most severely and kept most carefully away from any chance of intellectual awakening," close quote. In 1920, in The Behavior of Crowds, a psychological study, Everett Dean Martin warns that crowd behavior poses a serious menace to civilization that can be countered only by the rational middle class. As he put it, quote, We must become a cult, write our philosophy of life in flaming headlines, and sell our cause in the market. No matter if we meanwhile surrender every value for which we stand, we must strive to cajole the majority into imagining itself on our side. Close quote. In PR, A Social History of Spin, Stuart Ewan explains that corporate PR starts as a response to the threat of democracy and the need to create some kind of ideological link between the interests of big business and the interests of ordinary Americans. One of the first PR men in America was journalist Ivy Lee, who was hired by the Rockefeller family to diffuse public outrage over the Ludlow massacre. Lee provided the media with false information, claiming that striking miners had deliberately provoked the National Guard, who fought back only in self-defense. However, the first person to formulate a theory of public relations was Edward Bernays, the nephew of Sigmund Freud. In Propaganda, Bernays argues that propaganda is the modern instrument by which intelligent men can fight for productive ends and help to bring order out of chaos, close quote. Bernays began his career in public relations promoting World War I. Engineering consent to war. Never before in history had such a campaign of education been organized. Never before had American citizens realized how thoroughly, how irresistibly a modern government could impose its ideas upon the whole nation. Close quote. 1 week after the United States entered World War I, Washington established a Committee on Public Information, CPI, to mobilize journalists, artists, advertising experts, and social scientists to sell the war. The CPI faced an uphill battle. Americans did not want the war. Ordinary people saw no reason to be involved in a dispute between two rival empires fighting for territory and power. Just a few months earlier, President Woodrow Wilson had been reelected on a promise to keep America out of the war. Anti-war meetings were drawing thousands of people. To turn the country around, the CPI used a two-punch strategy, promoting the war with one fist and crushing the anti-war movement with the other. To sell the war, the CPI constructed a giant propaganda machine with a domestic section and a foreign section. Each section had multiple divisions. The news division sent press releases to every form of media on a 24-hour basis. The advertising division employed advertising agencies to flood the nation with pro-war posters and billboards. The Division of Pictorial Publicity and Bureau of Cartoons provided pro-war images. The Division of Films conscripted Hollywood to produce pro-war movies. Academics were assigned to write material promoting the war. Pro-war exhibits were mounted at fairs, in schools, and in churches. Teachers were given pro-war material to teach, and students were enrolled in speaking contests to support the war. The CPI's division of four-minute men recruited 75,000 businessmen and professionals to deliver short and seemingly spontaneous pro-war speeches in movie theaters, at picnics, and everywhere people gathered. Junior four-minute men made pro-war speeches in primary and secondary schools. An estimated 750,000 four-minute speeches were delivered in 5,000 American cities and towns. Hatred of the Germans was whipped up to a fever pitch. While one hand of the state promoted the war, the other hand silenced those who opposed it. To sell the war as a glorious venture binding rich and poor in a common cause, the CPI hid the truth about war profiteers, soldiers' mutinies, and anti-war protests. Most importantly, the unprecedented level of slaughter could not be acknowledged. 10 million lives were lost on the battlefield, and 20 million more died from hunger and disease. 50,000 American soldiers perished in fewer than 19 months. The director of the CPI sat on the U.S. Censorship Board. Before publication, all newspapers and magazines had to submit articles to this board for approval. Editors who refused to cooperate could be prosecuted. Their publications could be denied mail service, and their source of newsprint could be cut off. No anti-war material was allowed through the mails. The mainstream media did not protest. On the contrary, the New York Times proclaimed, quote, "It is the duty of every good citizen to communicate to proper authorities any evidence of sedition that comes to his notice," close quote. When the U.S. entered the war, Congress passed the Espionage Act that made it a federal crime to oppose the war. Four Minutemen implored their audiences to report anyone expressing anti-war views. The American Vigilante Patrol attacked those who opposed the war. With a membership of 100,000 people in 600 towns and cities, the American Protective League claimed to uncover 3 million cases of such disloyalty. 2,000 anti-war activists were prosecuted and 900 were imprisoned. Socialists at the core of the anti-war movement were targeted. Prominent labor leader and socialist Eugene Debs was sentenced to 10 years in jail for speaking out against the war. Interjecting here, excuse me, but is this a description of anything but fascism? This is real American history. Anyway, I continue. America got behind the war. As one writer observed, we hated with a common hatred that was exhilarating. At one church meeting, a speaker demanded that the Kaiser, when captured, be boiled in oil, and the entire audience stood on chairs to scream its hysterical approval. This was the kind of madness that had seized us. To the delight and relief of the ruling class, the CPI had made the unthinkable acceptable. Practice makes perfect. Over the following century, Washington had many more opportunities to push unpopular measures and disable the opposition. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. The Communist Menace. In the 2 years following the end of World War II, the CIO, Congress of Industrial Organizations, launched the greatest strike wave in the history of the United States. Millions of workers in the steel, auto, railroad, mining, maritime, and tobacco industries were among those who took part. Workers had kept their no-strike pledge during the war as an act of patriotism. But now the war was over, a new era was beginning, and these industrial workers were determined to shape it. The ruling class was enraged. The demands of American workers were standing in the way of a U.S. victory over Russia in the Cold War. To fight the Cold War, the U.S. had to maintain a huge military establishment on a near-permanent war footing. Supporting that military establishment required the diversion of billions of dollars from pressing domestic needs. To sell this kind of sacrifice to a population that had just emerged from the Second World War, Truman would have to scare the hell out of the country. Anti-communist propaganda was used to purge the labor movement of socialists and other radicals and to get America behind the Cold War. This period was known as the McCarthy era, named after the most zealous anti-communist, Senator Joseph McCarthy, Republican, Wisconsin. McCarthyism was the most widespread and longest-lasting wave of political repression in American history. In order to eliminate the alleged threat of domestic communism, a broad coalition of politicians, bureaucrats, and other anti-communist activists hounded an entire generation of radicals and their associates, destroying lives, careers, and all the institutions that offered a left-wing alternative to mainstream politics and culture. That anti-communist crusade used all the power of the state to turn dissent into disloyalty and in the process drastically narrow the spectrum of acceptable political debate. Between March 1947 and December 1952, 7 million federal government workers were fingered as potential Russian spies. Let me read that again. 7 million federal government workers were fingered as potential Russian spies. The investigations relied on secret evidence and paid informers and were conducted without judge or jury. Sound familiar? Although not a single case of espionage was confirmed, the witch hunt intensified, penetrating every level of society. State governments, colleges and universities, trade unions and civic organizations purged workers and members who refused to sign loyalty oaths. The repression reached absurd levels. People applying for licenses to fish in New York reservoirs had to sign loyalty oaths. Physics students at the University of Chicago feared that signing a petition calling for the installation of a Coke machine in the laboratories would signal their disloyalty. Conservative union leaders were happy to cooperate in removing militants who challenged their leadership. Between 1949 and 1950, the CIO expelled 11 Communist Party-led unions, more than 10% of its total membership. By 1954, 59 unions banned communists from holding union office, and 40 unions prohibited communists from being union members. The witch-hunting frenzy reached its peak when Julius and Ethel Rosenberg were charged with conspiracy to commit espionage and sentenced to death, despite the absence of any credible evidence that they were spies. Around the world, people campaigned to save the Rosenbergs. Unions submitted protest petitions. The Pope appealed for clemency. Albert Einstein and other Nobel Prize winners protested, along with many famous writers and artists, including Pablo Picasso, Jean-Paul Sartre, Dashiell Hammett, Diego Rivera, and Frida Kahlo. Washington refused to back down and executed the Rosenbergs in 1953. Their execution case sent a chill through the ranks of the left. From the point of view of a young person, we all thought it could be our parents, recounts Arlene Tyner, a longtime activist whose family was involved in the Rosenberg clemency movement. Everybody felt, especially if you were Jewish, during the witch hunts that government could come and take away your parents and execute them. It was a direct threat to your survival, close quote. By the end of the 1950s, thousands had lost their jobs and countless families were ruined. Most important, the union movement had lost its best fighters. Operation Dixie, the CIO's project to organize black and white workers in the American South, was scuttled. With unions gutted and the working class divided, the capitalist class could drive up productivity, make the U.S. the strongest economy in the world, and win the Cold War. And that was the real purpose of the anti-communist campaign. More than 50 years later, the American labor movement and the American left have still not recovered. The anti-communist campaign proved so successful that it was repackaged for use in the 21st century. Only the terms have changed. Terrorist has been substituted for communist. Like the Cold War, the War on Terror demands that ordinary people support U.S. foreign policy. Those who resist the militarization of the economy, the destruction of other nations, and the loss of civil rights at home are denounced as terrorists and terrorist sympathizers. The war on communism and the war on terror both serve to keep the ruling class firmly in control. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. The Great Lie. The great lie of the 20th century was that the Cold War was a conflict between American democracy and Russian communism. In reality, the Cold War was a power struggle between two superpowers to determine which one would rule the world. Democracy had nothing to do with it, and neither did communism, as I shall explain. In 1917, the Russian working class revolted against a corrupt ruling class and the horrors of World War I. The working class took power but could not hold on to it. Economic ruin caused by the war, the devastation of the Civil War, and a subsequent trade blockade combined to strangle the revolution. With no food for the people, no raw materials for the factories, and no other revolution in Europe to come to its aid, the Russian Revolution was defeated. During the 1920s, capitalism was restored in Russia in the form of state capitalism. The state controlled production, and everyone worked for the state. Russia Incorporated fulfilled the two directives of capitalism, to seize surplus produced by the working class, and to compete or die in the Cold War with the United States. Both sides portrayed the Cold War as a conflict of ideologies. Russia called itself communist, which was equated with state control over the economy. The United States called itself democratic because it had an electoral system. In fact, state intervention was important to the economy of both nations, and neither nation exposed its top decision makers to the risk of popular elections. Masking the commonality between the U.S. and Russia was important for both ruling classes. Because conditions for Russian workers were so oppressive, Washington could claim that capitalism was better despite mass inequality and savage racism at home. Those who organized for social change or opposed America's wars could be denounced as agents of communism. Moscow reaped parallel benefits. Because conditions for American workers were so oppressive, Moscow could claim that communism was better, despite mass oppression at home. Those who organized for social change or opposed Russia's wars could be denounced as agents of capitalism. Pretending that they represented fundamentally different social systems instead of variations on the capitalist model made it easier for both the U.S. and Russia to advance their empires. In 1947, President Truman announced that America had a duty to combat communism, the Truman Doctrine, and promptly sent the Marines to Latin America to spread democracy. Not to be outdone, Russia dispatched the Red Army to Eastern Europe to liberate the population from capitalism. Portraying the United States as democratic and Russia as communist was brilliant propaganda that served both forms of capitalism, East and West, and confused people everywhere. Chris Harmon writes, quote, "Many socialists in the West and the Third World were misled into believing the rulers of the USSR were on their side, while many dissidents in the Eastern Bloc believed Western leaders who claimed to stand for freedom and democracy. Those who stood out against this nonsense at the beginning of the 1950s were tiny in number. Imperialism is democracy." Inspired by the French Revolution, slaves in Haiti fought to free themselves from French domination. You would think that a nation committed to democracy would welcome such a struggle. Not so. President Thomas Jefferson, oh, the great founding father, was horrified by the prospect of an independent black republic so close to American shores, and he supplied the French army with munitions to put down the rebellion. Against all odds, the slaves won their independence in 1804. Real democracy is a threat to capitalism. In 1915, U.S. Marines invaded Haiti and occupied it continuously until 1934. The invasion was justified by the racist argument that Haitians needed to be taught how to govern themselves. Before the troops left, Haiti's constitution was rewritten to allow American corporations to plunder the island's natural resources and exploit its population. In 2004, the U.S. invaded the island again, forced the democratically elected president into exile, imprisoned democratically elected government officials, and installed a U.S.-friendly military dictatorship. Again, the invasion was disguised as a humanitarian intervention. Why the need for deceit? Ordinary people won't support wars that benefit the rich and powerful, so imperial ventures must be given a noble character. As historian Howard Zinn points out, quote, "President Polk lied to the nation about the reason for going to war with Mexico in 1846. It wasn't that Mexico shed American blood upon American soil, but that Polk and the slave-owning aristocracy coveted half of Mexico. President McKinley lied in 1898 about the reason for invading Cuba, saying he wanted to liberate the Cubans from Spanish control. The truth is that he really wanted Spain out of Cuba so the island could be open to United Fruit and other American corporations. And everyone lied about Vietnam. President Kennedy about the extent of our involvement. President Johnson about the Gulf of Tonkin. And President Nixon about the secret bombing of Cambodia. They all claimed the war was to keep South Vietnam free of communism. but really wanted to keep South Vietnam as an American outpost at the edge of the Asian continent, close quote. After the U.S. defeat in Vietnam, it became more important to counter anti-war sentiment, so U.S. wars of conquest were promoted as humanitarian missions, removing a tyrant from power in Panama in 1989, countering an illegal invasion by Iraq in 1990 through 91, saving Somalians in 1992 through 1993. In 1999, Washington bombed parts of Yugoslavia supposedly to stop ethnic cleansing. As had been predicted, the bombing increased the flood of refugees. However, Washington achieved its real objective, to plant military bases in former Russian territory without arousing mass opposition at home. As Noam Chomsky points out, when you've got your boot on somebody's neck, you can't just say, I'm doing this because I'm a brute. You have to say, I'm doing it because they deserve it. It's for their own good, close quote. Compete or die ensures that the biggest bully rules. However, this cannot be admitted. The U.S. claims the right to impose its will on the world because it is morally superior to all other nations. The 20th century slogan, what's good for General Motors is good for America, has become the 21st century slogan, what's good for America is good for the world. Because it is the world's most heavily armed nation, the U.S. can dictate who can have nuclear weapons, the U.S. and its allies, and who cannot, opponents of the U.S., who can invade and occupy other countries, allies like Israel, and who cannot, enemies like Iraq. Which brutal dictators should be removed from power, Panama's uncooperative General Noriega, and which should be placed in power, Chile's cooperative Augusto Pinochet? Which crises to respond to, civil war in strategic areas like the Middle East, and which crises to ignore, civil war in less strategic areas like Africa? Who are terrorists, opponents of the U.S., and who are freedom fighters, supporters of the U.S.? Lies build on lies. The U.S. bombing of Afghanistan was named Operation Enduring Freedom. When weapons of mass destruction could not be found in Iraq, the invasion was recast as a war against tyranny and renamed Operation Iraqi Freedom. During his second inauguration speech, President Bush proclaimed, "The best hope for peace in our world is the expansion of freedom in all the world." Neglecting to mention U.S. military domination of the Balkans, the Middle East, the Philippines, and much of Latin America. Bush uttered the words free or freedom more than 25 times in fewer than 20 minutes. Such lies secure domestic support for war and seduce young people into the military in the mistaken belief that war can make the world a better place. War is peace. The soldier betrayed. I think when the world's most powerful medium colludes with the world's most powerful military to put propaganda in mainstream films and television shows, that has to have an effect on the American psyche. David L. Robb. In Operation Hollywood, How the Pentagon Shapes and Censors the Movies, David L. Robb explains how Hollywood collaborates with the Pentagon to show the U.S. government and military in the best possible light. Movie producers who want access to military ships, tanks, planes, bases, weapons, uniforms, or troops must accept Pentagon control over their film scripts. After the script is approved, a military advisor is stationed on the set to ensure that no unauthorized changes are made. The Pentagon also claims the right to pre-screen the film before its public release. Producers who reject Pentagon censorship are denied access to military props, and their films can be barred from military theaters and U.S. bases. Not surprisingly, Pentagon-approved war films are sanitized and Disneyfied, as Robb explains, quote, Hollywood producers have been known to turn villains into heroes, remove central characters, change politically sensitive settings, or add military rescues to movies that require none. There are no bad guys in the military. No fraternization between officers and enlisted troops. No drinking or drugs. No struggles against bigotry. The military and the president can't look bad. Close quote. Pro-war films encourage young people to join the armed forces. When soldiers discover the brutal reality of war, they feel deceived. In Achilles in Vietnam, Combat Trauma and the Undoing of Character, Jonathan Shea explains how people of good character can go berserk when they are betrayed by their superiors. The betrayal of the soldier takes many forms: lying about the reason for the mission, inadequate training and faulty equipment, incompetent officers, and having to kill innocent people. All these things happened to American soldiers in Vietnam and are happening again in Afghanistan and Iraq. Living under constant attack, never feeling safe, and suffering the loss of one's closest comrades can combine with the bitterness of betrayal to unravel the most upstanding person. Such conditions provoke the atrocities of war. More than one parent of a veteran has cried, "I gave them a good boy, and they sent me back a murderer." The Army has total control over its soldiers and should be held accountable for their behavior. Shea explains how officers encourage soldiers to turn their grief into revenge, yet superiors take no responsibility when grief-stricken soldiers go berserk and lose their restraint, their morality, and their humanity. In 2005, SPC Charles A. Grainer Jr. was sentenced to 10 years in military prison for torturing prisoners at Iraq's Abu Ghraib prison. Grainer was condemned as a torture ringleader, while the top officers who supervised the prison system were cleared of any responsibility. Meanwhile, the mastermind of U.S. torture policy, Alberto Gonzalez, was rewarded with the top job at the Department of Justice. Betrayal doesn't come any bigger than that. While the people in power promote war as necessary for peace, prosperity, and security, peace never comes. Only the wealthy prosper, and life becomes increasingly insecure. The ordinary American, the American soldier, and the people they are supposed to hate all are victimized by the powerful people who call the shots. And I'm reading from Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal. Pay the piper, pick the tune. This is an industry. It's a business. We exist to make money. We exist to put commercials on the air. The programming that is put between those commercials is simply the bait we put in the mousetrap. ABC Nightline anchor Ted Koppel. The media are supposed to be objective and unbiased. In reality, the mainstream media are the voice of corporate America. A handful of corporations dominate radio, and five giant conglomerates command the print and television media. Business also controls the media through advertising dollars. Magazines obtain half their revenues from advertising. Newspapers get three-quarters of their income from advertising. And radio broadcasting depends almost entirely on advertising. The media avoids stories that might offend corporate sponsors. Fearing a lawsuit, Fox Network refused to air a report on the health risks of milk produced using Monsanto Corporation's growth hormone. According to reporters Steve Wilson and Jane Acree, Fox's lawyer told them, quote, "It doesn't matter if the facts are true," close quote. When Wilson and Acree protested, Fox's manager replied, quote, "We paid $3 billion for these television stations. We will decide what the news is. The news is what we tell you it is," close quote. Journalists are not allowed to challenge the media's pro-business, pro-Washington bias. Fox fired Wilson and Acree. The New York Times fired Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Sidney Schamberg for writing about corporate power and corruption. The San Jose Mercury fired Gary Webb for reporting how the CIA brought cheap cocaine into the U.S. to fund anti-government terrorists in Nicaragua. Most of the time, such discipline is not necessary because most journalists share their employers' pro-capitalist, anti-labor views. Media bias becomes most obvious in times of war. Amy Goodman, host of radio program Democracy Now! Explains, quote, "The media are the same corporations that profit from war. During the 1991 Gulf War, CBS was owned by Westinghouse and NBC was owned by General Electric. They made most of the parts for most of the weapons used in the war. So it's no accident that what we were watching on TV was a military hardware show," close quote. In Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of Mass Media, Edward S. Herman and Noam Chomsky explain that the media depend predominantly on information provided by government, business, military, and other experts who are funded and approved by these primary sources and agents of power. Journalists who rely on the establishment for information inevitably become the voice of the establishment. Reflecting on his experience as a correspondent during World War II, John Steinbeck wrote, "We were all part of the war effort. We went along with it, and not only that, we abetted it. Gradually, it became a part of us that the truth about anything was automatically secret, and to trifle with it was to interfere with the war effort. At that time, we believed, fervently believed, that it was the best thing to do," close quote. To ensure that its policies are promoted, the U.S. government pays individuals and PR firms to plant stories in the media. In 1991, the public relations firm of Hill and Knowlton brought a 15-year-old Kuwaiti girl to testify before a congressional caucus. The girl stated that she had personally witnessed Iraqi soldiers invading Kuwaiti hospitals, ripping infants from their incubators and leaving them to die on the floor. This atrocity was used to justify a U.S. war against Iraq. In fact, there was no atrocity. The girl turned out to be the daughter of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States, and subsequent investigations found not a shred of evidence for her claims. The story was pure PR. In other words, a lie. In 1991, the CIA hired a different PR firm to spread the story that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. After the 2003 invasion, the Pentagon hired more PR firms to plant pro-American stories in the Iraqi media. Although these stories were written by U.S. troops, they were presented as unbiased reports by independent journalists. One Pentagon official confessed to reporters, quote, "Here we are trying to create the principles of democracy in Iraq. Every speech we give in that country is about democracy. And here we're breaking all the first principles of democracy," close quote. Washington also plants propaganda in the media at home. Between 2003 and the first half of 2005, the Bush administration paid public relations firms, advertising agencies, media organizations, and individuals almost $2 billion to promote its policies. Okay, folks, that's $2 billion of your tax dollars paid to lie to you. Journalists were paid to write articles supporting the government's viewpoint, and PR firms were hired to create favorable video news releases that were broadcast as if they were independent news reports. Ironically, Washington was spending more to produce fake news than media networks were budgeting for real news, or so-called real news. When the Congressional Government Accountability Office ruled that such activities were illegal and deceptive, covert propaganda, the Justice Department instructed all government agencies to disregard the ruling. The government doesn't have to tell the media what to say. They already know it. During the U.S. bombing of Afghanistan, the chairman of CNN sent a memo to his staff stating that, quote, "It seems perverse to focus too much on the casualties or hardship in Afghanistan." He instructed them to balance coverage of civilian devastation with reminders that it is the country's leaders who are responsible for the situation Afghanistan is now in, close quote. CNN's head of standards and practices suggested various ways to convey that information, such as, "We must keep in mind that these U.S. military actions are in response to a terrorist attack that killed close to 5,000 innocent people in the U.S. He emphasized that, even though it may start sounding rote, it is important that we make this point each time. The result is media grief over the deaths of Americans and media silence in response to the deaths of non-Americans. Why we believe them. You can say anything you want during a debate, and 80 million people hear it. So what if it's not true? Maybe 200 people read the correction, or 2,000, or 10,000. Before the 2003 invasion of Iraq, 80% of Americans thought that the president was saying that Iraq either had weapons of mass destruction, WMD, or was in the process of developing them. 70% believed that the administration was saying that Iraq was directly or indirectly responsible for the attacks on the World Trade Center. These beliefs crossed party lines and were linked with support for the war. At the same time, a series of UN inspectors found no evidence of WMD. A CIA report concluded that Iraq's WMD capability had been destroyed in 1991. And the 9/11 Commission found no connection between Iraq and the bombing of the World Trade Center. Nevertheless, on the eve of the 2004 presidential election, 49% of Americans still believed that Iraq had WMD, and 52% still believed that Iraq was involved in the attack on New York. We know why Washington lied about the reasons for the war. They knew that the American public would not support a war for oil. The more important question is, why do people believe these lies? Why do they believe a president who assures them that America has no interest in building an empire, only in promoting democracy and freedom around the world? Part of the answer is because we want to believe this. We want to believe that people in power have the best of intentions and are genuinely concerned for our safety and future. We want to trust them because we want to feel safe. Trust connects people. Because human beings are social creatures, we want to give others the benefit of the doubt. Every con artist relies on this willingness to trust. At the same time, all social species have a built-in ability to detect when they are being unfairly treated. The successful con artist must avoid triggering the victim's sense of being cheated or deceived. The best way to disarm distrust is to build a relationship. Very wealthy politicians will mimic the dress and speech patterns of ordinary folks to imply, "I'm just like you." To preserve an important relationship, people will ignore their gut feeling that something is wrong and refuse to believe that a spouse is unfaithful, that a child is stealing, or that a president is lying. The willingness to trust is bolstered by the desire to avoid the pain of betrayal. The American public had the option of believing the president or feeling massively betrayed, so they gave him the benefit of the doubt. Consider the fable of the emperor who wore no clothes. Everyone went along with the lie that he was clothed because they feared to admit the truth. In relationships where one person is more powerful and the other is less powerful, and there seems to be no alternative to this arrangement, the less powerful person will protect the connection with a more powerful person, even when that person cannot be trusted. This phenomenon is called the Stockholm Syndrome, after a 1973 bank robbery in Sweden where hostages defended their captors. The same phenomenon can be seen in maltreated children who defend the adults who hurt them. These children will forget the abuse, forgive the abuser, and blame themselves instead. Battered adults who cannot escape will also make excuses for their abusers and blame themselves. There is some logic to this. As long as people feel powerless, it feels safer to trust the people with power. A captive who turns against a captor, a child who turns against an abusive parent, and a battered spouse who turns against the batterer all risk greater harm and possible death. The more dependent we feel on our rulers, the more willing we are to reject evidence that discredits them, no matter how convincing it is. When authorities reassure us that their greatest concern is our well-being, we long to believe them. No matter how often they swindle us, we look for signs that they are right and we are wrong. We forgive them again and again. Our amnesia flows from the mistaken belief that submission is the only option. If people acknowledged that the president, his administration, and the media were all lying to them, what would they do? Facing the truth is an option only when there is some alternative or some hope of an alternative in the existing social arrangement. In terms of the Middle East wars, the American people saw no alternative. During the 2004 election, the Democrats supported the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq and viciously attacked the only anti-war candidate, Ralph Nader. The anti-war movement collapsed to support the Democrats, and the revolutionary left was too small to make a difference. When Bush was reelected, many people turned from politics to religion, needing something to believe in and someone they could trust. No one can stand alone against the system. When people organize to fight for their rights, they find it easier to reject the lies that bind them to their oppressors. Social support helps to clear the brain, allowing people to see the world as it is and the possibility of creating a better world. While lies keep the majority confused, lies are not enough to keep the ruling class in power. Someone must take responsibility for social problems. The next chapter explains how the ruling class protects the system by blaming its victims and convincing them to blame themselves and each other. Summary. If the structure of society were ordained by God or nature, there would be no need for rulers to lie. However, society is created by human beings and can be changed by them. The capitalist class needs the consent of the majority to rule, so it cannot tell the truth. That its primary concern to maximize profit conflicts with what most people want to meet human needs. The majority will believe the lies they are fed as long as they see no alternative and feel powerless to create one. And that's the conclusion of Chapter 9 in Power and Powerlessness by Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006.